TSN 1290, CFRW Winnipeg. All sports.
This is my spot.
All the time. A division of Bell Media.
If you want to know the real deal about the three, we're going to take it with triple chop. We're going to bring you up to speed.
TSN 1290 presents the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg.
That ended abruptly, and I don't think my mic's on.
You are.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. Good morning, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba, and for all those joining us live at tsn1290.ca. Good afternoon, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg. Richard Pollock is away this week, and we're thrilled to be joined instead by, you know him from LegalCurve.com, comes on the show every now and then. Dave Manuk, good afternoon.
Thank you, Drew. Welcome. It's good to be back on the show.
It's been a while, I got to say, probably. Since last November, when we were in New York?
With you and Ez, yes. That's true. But, I mean, if you'll recall, I was on the show with Remo, and earlier, I think it was earlier this summer, wasn't it?
It was in Kentucky when we were in Kentucky.
Right.
I was going to say, you forget your wedding when I had to cover. When I was hosting, in fact.
Right. I remember now.
How quick they forget favors done.
Yeah, you know, out of sight, out of mind, that sort of thing.
Fair enough. Absolutely.
You should really be introducing Dave Manuk as the king of new media, though.
That's only you have declared him the king of new media.
No, the people have declared him the king of new media, so he's the king of new media, Dave Manuk, and we're honored to have Dave M., obviously usual editor of LegalCurve.com, on the show, and Richie is enjoying a little Bruce Springsteen in Chicago right now. I don't know if he's there yet, but tonight is the concert.
He's midway, somewhere in Wisconsin. Yep.
Good state, though, Wisconsin.
It is good.
Anyways, big show for you this afternoon. 3 hours as we're back to our regular start time, noon to 3 here on the normal version of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We took a bit of the abbreviated version in the summer. The summer is now over now that we're past Labor Day. So 3 hours going forward, noon to three here on TSN 1290. Coming up in about 30 minutes' time, we're going to be joined by Ed Willis of the Vancouver Province. It is the 25th anniversary of the Canada Cup this week. Ed Willis wrote a great book about the 1987 Canada Cup called Gretzky to Lemieux, the story of the 1987 Canada Cup. We're going to talk about that tournament. One of the furthest hockey memories I have was that 87 tournament. We'll get into that throughout the show. Also joining us today is Bill Lindsay. He's the television analyst of the Florida Panthers. He's going to join us in about 60 minutes time or so to talk about the Florida Panthers, their offseason. Roberto Luongo came out, said he wants to be traded there. We'll talk about all that with Bill Lindsay. In the last hour, Kalen Qualley, Pass It Forward Hockey Equipment Program, is starting up again for, I believe, the fourth year.
Yep.
We'll talk to Kalen about that because that's a great program, and we're proud to support that program. And then switching gears a little bit in that last hour, the Goldeyes, big win last night, sweeping the Fargo Moorhead Redhawks. Paul Edmonds, the voice of the Winnipeg Goldeyes here on TSN 1290, is going to join us as we transition for about 15, 20 minutes from the Illegal Curve Hockey Show to the Illegal Pitch Baseball Show.
Honored to have Paul Edmonds on. We did the show earlier this year in the spring at Shaw Park. Paul Edmonds is the best in the business, and we're really happy to have him on. It's great. Goldeyes have moved on. They swept their arch nemesis, Fargo Moorhead. So it's going to be fun to have him on and talk about everything, hopefully, but the CBA, right?
Hopefully everything but that. We're going to get, we'll talk about the CBA now for the next couple segments.
Oh, damn.
Sorry. We'll get through it. We'll be done with it at that point in time. And then we'll talk about real hockey at that point in time after we get through it. The union and the player and the owners, the big four, as we like to call them, the Fair Brothers, Bill Daly, Gary Bettman, met yesterday in New York, supposedly informal conversations. I'm not certain what the difference is between when they have formal conversations and informal conversations, but they met yesterday. Then they took a break for a couple hours in the middle of the afternoon, and then they met again yesterday evening. Just come out. No meeting scheduled for today. They're not going to meet today, but there is a possibility that they are going to resume meetings again, possibly Sunday or even Monday. I mean, if you flash back a week, 7 days ago, they weren't. All lines of communication had been broken off. They were in recess. The meetings were. I guess if you're, as a hockey fan, it's at least a good sign that they're back talking to one another as they did yesterday in what you know, and it was more than just a 20-minute conversation. So hopefully that's a good sign, but we don't really know what the conversations were about.
The reports in the media yesterday were positive in the sense that the four principals were really in the room meeting, having discussions. So that was good.
Couple players there as well. Zeeman Konopka, Ron Hainsey of the Winnipeg Jets.
Yeah.
And there's another player whose name escapes me at the moment.
So it's good in that sense that you have all the principals there. They're actually having conversations. But the big thing, and we've been writing about this on illegalcurve.com, there's been no urgency.
We should actually keep track of how many times you plug illegalcurve.com.
Okay. Well, one officially.
Yeah.
So, but the point I'm making is that there's been no urgency. Like, it's actually a snail's pace at which these guys are progressing. And the irony, of course, is, and not a surprise, we've been talking about this for 6 weeks, how there's been this complete lack of urgency. They're having, you know, like, look, as you said, they met for 45 minutes, and then they agree to resume. And I understand, look, it's comprehensive. It's collective bargaining. It's not something that you can just hash out in a few minutes or a few hours. But the point is, you know, these guys are all getting paid. They're getting paid big dollars. And the reality is they can meet for more than 45 minutes. They could be having all day sessions because the truth is that's what they should be doing.
Well, you know, I don't mind if they don't meet every single day. Because sometimes, you know, you meet, you have an exchange of you exchange ideas, and then you have to go away and you have to sort of remove yourself from the process to fully evaluate what the other side has been saying. So when they recessed last Friday, so, you know, 8 days ago when they recessed and there was all, you know, it didn't sound like things were going well. There were no further talks, you know, scheduled or anything along those lines. I don't mind if they stop meeting Friday and then they meet again and then they take the weekend off. I can live with that just so that they both can gain some perspective by moving away from the situation. But for it to take a whole week to gain that perspective and start up these quote unquote informal discussions again, it shows to me that there still isn't that urgency there. And I understand that it's all about posturing and it's all about, you know, sort of trying to gain a little bit of leverage and a little bit of an upper hand. But a full week between meetings at this stage, at this juncture, is just far too long.
And I think it's all about intentions. I mean, is the NHL really interested in coming to a deal? I mean, we're a week away. So, yeah, for fans, I mean, it's great to hear that the Fear Brothers and Gary Bettman and Bill Daly met on Friday for informal talks because there was nothing from Monday to Thursday. But we're a week away here, and you're going to start to talk about canceling training camp a week to 10 days from now. And if you cancel training camp, that means that the season will probably start a little bit later. So sure, it's great that there's informal talks, but really I think it's pretty clear to me that the intentions are that the season isn't going to start. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, the chances of the season starting on time are less than 0.001%. So I mean,
is that a scientifically proven number?
Unfortunately not. But there's absolutely no chance that either side intends to actually come to an agreement before then. So now really what they're doing is they're creating a framework going forward. And sure, there's a chance that that this season still starts sometime in October. But really, I mean, you're still very far apart. Each side, even though, of course, there's going to be rhetoric in the media, the reality is they're still not going to really come close to a resolution, I think, really closer to when the season was supposed to start.
You know, it came out earlier this week that Bill Daly called the players, said they don't have, you know, much urgency, and they're not taking the September 15th deadline, you know, very seriously. And you know what? I can totally see why. I mean, do you think really players want to go through maybe training camp and meaningless exhibition games if they don't have to?
That was the voice of Michael Remus, producer of the show, and he's occasionally going to jump on throughout the program. Good morning there, Remus, as well. Good afternoon, rather.
Thanks. I want to apologize for not having the computer on when we started. That was my fault.
That's okay. Don't worry. We'll just take you out back, and we'll beat you up a little bit later on. Or we'll just run the bus over you throughout the show as we get going. But, you know, you make a good point. The September 15th deadline, to me, is not as significant as, say, October 8th, October 9th. You know, you can start this, you know, if the season starts a week late, I don't think people are going to be ripping their hair out too much about it. You can adjust for that relatively easily. It's if they're not, you know, talking, if there's no sign of anything happening by that first week of October, that's going to really be a problem. Look, if they're in discussions, and they're in discussions all next week, and, you know, next Saturday hits, and that's the 15th, and, you know, the midnight deadline happens, and officially they're locked out on the 16th. But they're still having fruitful conversations. I'm okay with that. The problems are is when there's no conversations whatsoever, like we saw this past week. Yes, just the fact that they're in the room and they're talking is a reasonable sign. You know, that's just to me, that's what matters more than anything else, is that they're still in conversation with one another. They haven't burned no bridges have been burned. It's not going to require, you know, a lot of apologizing just to get back to the step at where they're at talking to one another.
Right. Really? And even though, you know, it was a good sign that they met informally, and, you know, the Board of Governors meetings are happening next week.
And the players, and there's about 200 players expected for meetings in New York as well.
Right, and so that's really, I mean, that's important, but I mean, that's basically at that point, it's going to be, okay, are we going to sign this thing, you know, at the last minute or not? But the question really is, as far as the game plan goes for the NHLPA, and you know, the NHL goes, how long is the NHL prepared to take this? We know that back in 2004... Bob Goodenow and Ted Saskin, the NHLPA, they were prepared to sit out a year. And the NHL was obviously also prepared to lock them out for a year, knowing that they needed that salary cap. This year it's completely different. And do they want to take this thing into January? Do they want to take this thing into April, God forbid, to basically get a bigger percentage of hockey-related revenue? I don't think they do. So right now, I mean, it's a guessing game. Really, it's either the season's going to start now or we're going to get a half-season lockout.
Well, you know, I think a big difference between now and 04 is the competition that Gary Bettman's up against. Look, I'm not saying Bob Goodenow is a stupid individual. Obviously, he's not. But there was no unity in the Players Association, and that began to see the fractures in that as the lockout continued. Donald Fair, the guy up against Gary Bettman, is as much of a master manipulator, and I don't say that in a negative sense, but he likes to play mind games as much as Gary Bettman likes to play mind games. There's a great article. I'll link to it right now on our Twitter page, at Illegal Curve. You can find it there. There's a great article that talks about Donald Fair and how he was able to achieve labor peace in baseball for so many years, and a lot of that was through sort of, for lack of better term, psychological warfare that tended to give him an upper hand over Bud Selig as his chief negotiating partner or adversary. Mm-hmm. And those same sort of tactics are being used against Gary Bettman. And I don't think Gary Bettman's used to not being the smartest guy in the room at all times.
It's interesting, actually, because Paul Kelly, the former NHLPA executive director, was just interviewed on ESPN.com this week, and he said that the players are more unified now than they ever have been before.
Yep.
But he also says, how long is that unification going to last? Because now these guys are going to start losing paychecks. And at what point does a guy who's losing, you know, $300,000, I mean, that money's never coming back.
And obviously, Dave, there is escrow, so the players will get money, but still, that doesn't replace the fact is, if you're a guy who's got maybe 1 year left in his career, or a guy that really might be affected by there not being a season, being a guy who is coming off a good year, and really this is a shot to make the NHL, those guys are going to be affected. But you're right, there is better unity in the NHL, and unfortunately, I don't think the players really are interested in missing a full year of hockey this time
around. I don't think they are either. But you're absolutely right that until it begins to affect somebody in the pocketbook, you know, there's no push come to shove at that point.
Right.
But when you're starting to take money out of somebody's pocket, that's really when it becomes an issue.
And I truly think, like, even though both sides are kind of playing it down, the Winter Classic still remains the number one factor for the NHL. They don't want to lose it. It's a big scale every year. But when you got Detroit and Toronto, you're playing at the Big House in Michigan, it's going to be insane. And NBC's involved. You just can't see them doing whatever. They'll do whatever it takes to get it done before, you know, that it impacts that game.
Yeah.
We'll see. Let's go to break. When we come back, we'll do another segment on the CBA, and then we'll move on to real, quote-unquote, hockey. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This is TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg. Dave Manuk sits in for Richard Pollock, and producer Remus gets us on and off the air. You can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And, of course, the Winnipeg Jets morning paper is available at www.illegalcurve.com.
They're quite extensive today, so make sure you check them out.
There you go. There's the man who does them each and every morning.
Drew, if I could have a couple seconds right now.
Can I do a segment sponsorship first?
Oh, of course. That's what's paying for my mortgage right now.
Well, then we're all in trouble in that case. In that case, there's a foreclosure sale going to be happening on Beaverbrook or wherever you live. Anyways, new sponsor here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're thrilled to welcome them to the program. The Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba is our newest sponsor. CGA Association of Manitoba is the largest, fastest growing, and most diverse accounting body in Manitoba. Did you know that CGAs are among the top 5% of income earners in all of Canada with an average yearly salary of $72,000 for new graduates? For more information, contact the CGA Association of Manitoba at cga-manitoba.org or give them a call at 204-477-1256. The Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba. We see more than numbers.
Very happy that we've got that new new sponsor, CGA Association. I'm hoping that they can help me out with some of my assets because I've had a lot of trouble lately counting all my money. I mean, I've got so much of it. I'm just, it's in closets and everything. So I'm hoping that they can somehow, you know, tell me how I can, you know, invest that or spend it.
So they'll just count it for you also.
Or just count it, yeah. Because, okay. I mean, I started counting. I get up to, you know,
is this what you needed
400 million and I just...
Is this what you needed the second few seconds for? Is this what it was?
No, actually, in all seriousness, I'd like to give a shout-out to the Carles hockey team, the hockey team that Remus and I play on, and Drew has played on before. Richie plays on the team as well.
You can't congratulate yourself on winning something. No, I have to congratulate you for that.
No, I'm giving our team a shout-out for winning the division... D2A Highlander Championship.
Whoa, you don't need to say the division. No one needs to know how bad we are.
At that point, you lose it.
Hey, Reem, you're a rock back on defense. No, but we won last night 4-3, so I want to give a shout-out to all the boys. Remus and Richie are on the team, everybody else. So
congratulations, boys, on winning that illustrious championship.
There was a trophy.
I'm sure there was.
We actually did a little bit of a tour.
I'm sure there was. Getting back to the lockout for a little while longer, it was came out this week that, you know, Bettman and Fair and Daly and all those guys, they're not going to take salaries during the lockout. As if this is supposedly some sort of fabulously magnanimous offer that they're going to take.
Magnanimous.
Magnanimous.
Somebody get a thesaurus so I can...
magnanimous. You know, pardon me, guys, but you're making $8 million bucks a year in the case of Gary Bettman. I'm sure the other guys aren't doing much worse off than that. Instead of not taking a salary, here's what I'd rather do. Take all the money and put it into a pool for all the employees who are no longer going to be able to work because there's not going to be hockey, we assume, for a period of time. All the concession people at the arenas, all the support staff that goes into the National Hockey League, those are the ones who I'm more concerned about, the people who do rely on their paychecks on a day-by-day basis. That are really the ones nobody talks about as being affected by this lockout.
Yeah, they try to use this the NHLPA tried to use this because originally Bettman was going to receive his $8 million salary during this time.
Yeah.
And then he came back and removed that leverage point and said, look, you know, I'm not taking a salary either anymore. And you're absolutely right, Drew. I mean, you should be taking that salary and parse it through to the people who need it, because those are people who rely on a paycheck week to week, or, you know, every couple of weeks whenever they get it. And they're sitting there and they're not going to be getting it. So you've got millionaires and billionaires who are acting like they're, you know, doing something special by saying, you know what, I'm not going to take part of my $8 million salary. Well, isn't that nice? But what happens to the guy who's making $8,000 a year? And now suddenly you're removing a quarter of a season. Well, how does he support himself? How does he support, fine, not 8,000, but let's say like 20,000, whatever the
average
is. The
guy who's working an hourly wage at the arena to do whatever it needs to do, and all the auxiliary businesses that are affected by the lack of hockey.
Yeah.
Those are the guys that I, you know, are far more concerned about than any of these, than, you know, the fact that Fair and Bettman don't take a salary. But, well, guys, I'm not going to give you a standing ovation and a parade down the street for that.
That's why these it's preposterous whenever anybody tries to represent that they're doing this for anybody but themselves. Like, I don't really care that the players want, you know, to maintain what they've got, or that the owners want it, but just don't phrase it in any way other than what it is, which is that you want money and you want to make money, and that's fine. Everybody's entitled to make money in life. But the point is, don't make it look like you're doing this because you're sacrificing for the fans, because or as Drew's pointing out, these you know, the workers.
Well, you talk about the fans, and that'll lead us. Bruce Arthur in the National Post really laid it out bare in an article earlier this week, and again, I'll tweet that on our Twitter page right now, at Illegal Curve. The headline, and I mean, obviously the writer of the article doesn't necessarily write the headline, is fans are just afterthoughts in the NHL labor battle. And it really is the truth of the matter. The fans don't matter. And the only time that the fans will matter is when the fans begin to hurt the owners in the pocketbook.
Well, you just nailed it. The reason why the fans are an afterthought, and they were an afterthought in 2004, 2005 during the previous lockout.
I think the fans were more naive in 2004 when they actually believed Gary Bettman in saying cost certainty will result in ticket prices being lower.
Right, which was obviously, you know...
If he dared to trot out that line in this negotiation, people would string him up.
Right, and that obviously never happened. That never materialized. But the fans are obviously an afterthought for the simple fact that they're being taken for granted. Both sides are taking the fans for granted. They know that when this is over, whether the lockout is a week or whether it's a year, the majority of fans, especially in Canada and the strong American markets, will come back. They'll wait. Fans were prepared to wait 2 years, last time around. Fans are being taken for granted. They know that all the revenue comes for the people that buy NHL center ice, the people that buy season tickets, the people that buy individual tickets, and everyone has to suffer. And this time around, I think neither side, even though I think the players are winning the PR war, maybe not so much as they were a little while ago, but they're still winning. And like you said, last time around, the owners were winning because, you know, the contracts got a little bit out of control. But this time around, the fans are just fed up, and all the fans want is to watch their favorite team play. People who have season tickets, the Winnipeg Jets, the Edmonton Oilers, the Calgary Flames, they just want to be able to watch hockey. All of this nonsense about hockey-related revenue and all that, hockey players are extremely well paid. When you think about, you know, the last 4 or 5 years with the recession, what's going on in the U.S., what's going on here, these guys are so well paid. The owners are experiencing record levels of revenue, and sure, the NHL as a whole, it came out earlier this week that the NHL as a whole lost a few hundred million dollars.
I don't believe that for one second. I want to talk about that. I think that is the biggest load of words I can't say on the radio right
baloney.
Now. Baloney. Well, I'll go with baloney. But for the NHL to claim that they've lost $240 million in the past 2 years, that is and I can say this. I think it is nothing but a lie. I think that is a lie. These are smart business people. If they were legitimately forking over and losing $240 million from their net worth, then they would never be in this business to begin with. They would close up shop and they would walk away.
And you have to believe, though, that that is coming from six to ten teams.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, throughout the season, we hear from, the chief operating officer of the NHL, a guy named John Collins,
yep,
how league revenues have never been higher.
$3.1 billion.
Best year for revenues ever. TV ratings, merchandise, Winter Classic, HBO, whatever it may be. Never been better.
Yep.
And then they dare to have the nerve. And, there's only one word and that fits, and it's a Jewish word. It's a Yiddish word, chutzpah. And it means nerve. They dare to have the nerve to come out and claim they're losing $240 million. I call BS
on
that claim.
I'll be honest, Drew. I mean, I don't know. I mean, because the way they come up with that number is not known to me. That's beyond me.
You need to be a CGA.
Michael Remus has an accounting degree.
That's right. If you were a CGA, you would know that.
Exactly. But, last time around, I could see that because the revenues were way lower. But this time around, you look at the Jets coming back. They obviously didn't qualify for revenue sharing. They were in the top 15 of the NHL. They made money. The Toronto Maple Leafs, I believe I saw, they make $80 million a year, something like that. So it's tough to believe that the losses suffered by all 30 owners as a cumulative total are a couple hundred million dollars. But, that's something that they're going to use to show that that's why the players share the
revenue
should go down.
If your business was that poor, you wouldn't be in business.
No, the truth is that when teams say we've lost X, you always know that they might be losing X, but they could be making it up with Y. So, I mean,
that's just it.
What's their formula for coming up?
Yeah,
that number.
That's the whole point.
We're losing X, but all of our TV revenue goes into this numbered account that's also owned by us, but slightly separate than the
team. The point is the team could be owned by a separate entity. I mean, we never know how these corporations are made up anyway. So generally, it's not like it's a transparent organization. You don't know where things go in. It's all conjecture. Everybody guesses. Yep. It's all speculation. You say, do you know the numbers I've seen that people speculate, like a team like the Jets could make, or the team, like any team, but it's all a guess.
Because these teams are private corporations.
Which is fine. I don't expect them.
Absolutely.
I don't ask them to open up their books. I really don't. because it's a private business, and if I owned a private – look, nobody asked us to open up our illegal curve books. It's a very small book.
Very
small
it's
book.
It's not really a book. It's more like
plus,
just
Drew,
a
I'm pretty
note.
Sure I saw you on a boarding a flight to the Cayman Islands with said books.
That's
but go
right.
on.
Exactly.
With Gary Bettman.
But don't come out and tell me – I mean, it's not plausible. It's not plausible because these guys, I mean, it's just not reasonable that you're losing $240 million cumulatively as a league.
Drew, I'll say this much.
You wouldn't be in business.
Even with the Phoenix Coyotes, who are obviously losing money, the Islanders, the Florida Panthers, those teams at the bottom, I think even with those teams, and the it's clear that they lose money, I'm with you. I would think that by now the NHL would be in the black. But even back then in 2004 when you had more teams losing money, that number would have been higher. But, you know, again, the NHL is going to use their own number, and obviously the NHLPA is adamantly challenging that number. They're using that number to basically increase their position in the public
But if it's a completely unbelievable position, it's completely unbelievable. So but, who's actually, like, why would you even release it? All you're doing is that point in time is losing credibility.
Right.
By even pretending as though that's a legitimate number.
And the most important thing about this time around is that the NHL has lost credibility for two major reasons. Revenue is at an all-time high, and they're asking the players to roll back their salaries. And then they're, by at the same token, saying that they're giving players too much, players make too much money, and then signing them to 10-plus year, $200 million deals. So the owners this time around have lost almost all credibility.
The truth is, though, I think that was just a bad play. I mean, ultimately, I mean, obviously the NHL didn't come out and say that. I think it was leaked, but the reality
is... Well, it was leaked to Rene Lavoie of RDS. Somebody told that to Rene Lavoie.
So it's got to be taken to, you know, that's got to be taken into account, that it wasn't like the... But the point is...
Somebody leaked it on the NHL's behalf.
No, I realize that, and what I'm saying is, it was a bad play.
They should never have leaked it.
Absolutely.
Because there's no believability to
it. That's the whole point.
Absolutely. So, it's a bad PR move by even pretending
it was an attempt and it wasn't successful.
Let's go to break. When we come back, I'm going to lower my blood pressure a little bit.
Good.
And we're going to be joined by Ed Willis of the Vancouver Province, and we're going to discuss the 1987 Canada Cup.
Great jerseys.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. One of the most seminal moments in Canadian hockey history, the 1987 Canada Cup. Three straight 6-5 games won, the series won by Canada on that famous goal burned into the memory of hockey fans throughout Canada, coast to coast. Earlier this morning, we sat down with Ed Willis of the Vancouver Province. He is the author of Gretzky to Lemieux, the story of the 1987 Canada Cup. Here is that interview we conducted earlier this morning with Ed Willis. In addition to being a columnist for the province, he's also the author of a book regarding the 1987 Canada Cup called Gretzky to Lemieux, the story of the 1987 Canada Cup, a name well known to people in Winnipeg. Do you spend about a decade here, Ed?
Yeah, it was almost 8 years at the Sun.
Well, there you go. So you're well known to people in Winnipeg, so this should be a nice little walk down memory lane. It's the 25th anniversary of the Canada Cup. For myself, it's probably the first big international tournament that I can remember. You know, the series-winning goal from the 87 Canada Cup is one of the most memorable in Canadian hockey history. Gretzky, Lemieux, Howerchuk winning the draw there. Yet prior to that tournament beginning, there was a thought that Wayne Gretzky didn't even want to participate in it. How close did Wayne Gretzky come to deciding he was too burnt out from all the playoff battles in the NHL to play for Team Canada?
Yeah, I'm not sure if he was ever that close. I think he just needed some time to distance himself. When you look at that era of players, it's remarkable. I remember looking at both Gretzky and Mark Messier's hockey database, and there was like a five-year period where you count all-star games, playoffs, preseason games, and then these international tours and international tournaments where they played over 100 games a year. And I remember asking Mark about it, and he just said, well, we were into it. And they were into it. I think the larger problem might have been, and it's kind of been underreported, is there was a fatigue starting to set in at these big international tournaments. There'd been one in 81, been another one in 84, and now there was another one in 87. And then there's also some suspicion starting to arise about Alan Eagleson's role into it. So I honestly think that was the larger problem rather than Wayne's reticence reticence to play.
Ed, Mike Heenan was the coach of that 1987 Canada Cup team, and back then it was obviously a reasonable choice because of his success with the Philadelphia Flyers. But back then, was there any fear that Heenan's abrasive style was going to conflict with the superstars that he was going to work with, as opposed to, you know, the NHL roster that he was used to coaching?
Yeah, totally. In fact, he wasn't the first choice. The first choice was Glenn Sather for a couple of reasons, not the least of which was that team was so predominant in its Oilers composition. So I think there was five Oilers players on it, and they were very much formed the heart of the team. And of course, Keenan's Flyers were the heated rivals of those Oilers teams. So there was that. And then you throw in Mike's personality, and then you throw in Gretzky's personality, which is kind of at the opposite end of the Keenan spectrum. There was great potential for conflict, and of course, that played out very early on in the formation of the team, and I think was really one of the defining aspects of the team as it evolved.
One of the differences between putting together Team Canada in 1987 and one nowadays is the concept of a pre-tournament training camp. Given that the All-Star team that Team Canada has put together, why did the powers that be decide that a month-long training camp would be a prerequisite for beginning the tournament?
Yeah, that's a real good question, and I think you have to look at it within the context of the time. Players weren't as organized, they weren't as militaristic, they basically did what they were told to do. As things turned out in this case, that month-long training camp was needed. Because they needed to be in tip-top condition, because the Russians, training was an 11-month-a-year process. So the Canadians needed it, but as I said, I think you have to view it in the context of the time. When if you ask players to show up, they showed up. If you ask them to show up for a month-long training camp, they would show up. The other part was there was an awful lot of young players who were emerging who wanted to prove themselves at that camp. There was Doug Gilmore, there was Brian Propp. There's a lot of players who are kind of on the fringe who wanted the competition of the camp rather than just kind of a team that had been selected.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Ed Willis of the Vancouver Province. He's the author of Gretzky to Lemieux, the story of the 1987 Canada Cup. You know, that we talked about the training camp that the players went through, but it wasn't all whips and chains and that sort of thing. There was some fun times had by the players, you know, including their office. The players' office turned out to be an establishment, let's call it, Chez Paris in Montreal. Any sort of tales about their time at Chez Paris?
The Palais de Dance. my favorite one came from a reporter, and this was also an era when the media mixed pretty freely with the players, and there was obviously boundaries there, and I think they were observed by both sides. But this one story, there's a table full of media types at Chez Paris, and the American team comes in and they send a round of drinks over. But an hour later, the Canadian team comes in and they send a dancer over. They thought that was very revealing about the value systems of the two teams. But again, that was part of the very much a part of the culture, especially for those young Oilers. I mean, they went at it hard on the ice, and they went at it just as hard off the ice. And it's remarkable that they could play at the level they did. I just don't think you could do that in this day and age.
Well, just the scrutiny, if you tried to do that, would probably be too much for any player to handle.
Well, could you imagine, like, if for example, let me pull a name out of the sky and say Wayne Gretzky walked in with Mark Messier and Ray Bourque and Grant Pierre and sat down at the table. You could just see all the cell phone cameras coming out and the pictures, and they'd be up on Twitter within 5 seconds.
Yeah, absolutely. Back to the roster and the composition of Team Canada, you know, which player in your mind was the biggest surprise to have made the team, and who was the biggest omission from Team Canada in 1987?
Well, let me start with the first one, because I I'm going by memory here, and I remember there were just, when you look at it, for what the players would become and what they were at the time, there were just some startling personnel decisions. I think the biggest one was passing on Patrick Waugh in goal for Fuhr and Kelly Rudy, and I'm sorry, the third goalie escapes my memory
Ron
right
Hextall.
Now. Thank you, Ron Hextall, who was Keenan's guy. Ron wasn't quite, the icon he would become, but he'd won the Stanley Cup. in 86. He was, you know, he was, you know, a huge figure in Montreal, where a lot of the training camp took place. So, I mean, Keenan, in his mind, wasn't satisfied that Roy would accept a backup role, and he was always going to go with Fuhr, again, because of the Oiler makeup of the team and because Oiler, because Fuhr's chemistry worked so well with Gretzky, Messier, Coffey, all the other guys. So there was that one. And then the other one that sticks out in my mind, the Team Canada defense was kind of, once you got past Bork and Coffey, you start running into James Patrick and Craig Hartsburg, like good NHLers, but not exactly Hall of Famers. When you see Scott Stevens was cut when he was just emerging as a real, you know, a real franchise-type player with the Washington Capitals. I think that was one. And he was one of the guys who sounded off when he was cut. He did not take it well.
Ed, you look at you mentioned some of the defensemen, and when you look at the forwards on this team, obviously it could be argued, easily argued, that it was the best collection of offensive talent that's ever been assembled. But as you said, on the back end, aside from Paul Coffey and Ray Bourque, the defense wasn't as well regarded. How important was it for that Team Canada team, their psyche, to know that even though if they had those defensive shortcomings, they had Grant Fuhr and Nett as the last line of defense?
Yeah, and this is my further to my point about the personality of the team being an extension of the Oilers. You know, at that time, you know, the Oilers just played run and gun, and they were confident, and it didn't matter if the score, and this is the great thing about Fuhr and part of his legend, didn't matter if the score was 8-7, if it was 4-3, if it was 1-0, he would not allow that goal. Now, he did it once in the final series, and it took a perfect shot to beat him. But Canada was one shot away from elimination several times throughout that three-game series, and Fuhr did not let that goal in, and he let in some terrible goals. It's really funny when you look at the metrics by which goalies were measured at that time. If you had the save percentage, should have been about .875. I don't think Fuhr had a save percentage over 900 until later in his career. But when he was winning Stanley Cups with the Oilers, when he was regarded as the best goalie in the game, save percentage well under 900, goals against average 3.3 to 3.5, but he just made that one save he had to, and I think that really is a truer reflection of goaltending greatness.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. We're joined on the line by Ed Willis of the Vancouver Province, author of Gretzky to Lemieux, the story of the 1987 Canada Cup.
Ed, there were three straight 6-5 games in the finals versus the USSR. Had the Russians ended up prevailing, do you think the timeline of Russians entering the NHL would have been different? Or was it a foregone conclusion that this was going to be the final international tournament played behind the Iron Curtain?
I tend to think the latter, because there were forces in motion before the tournament started, and they seemed irresistible in nature. They had to do with Gorbachev taking power, with these concepts of perestroika, the change in Russian culture. Now, the change wasn't as fast in the sporting culture, but it was coming to Russian society as a whole. The players were also starting to get older, and there was a money crunch. So I think when you add all those things together, I think it was going to happen. Might not have happened maybe within I guess it was 2 years that the first wave came over, Fetisov, Larionov, Krutov, et cetera. But I think it was going to happen regardless of the outcome of that tournament.
Ed, when you talk about a team that had both Mario Lemieux and Wayne Gretzky on it, it would only seem natural, at least to us, that those two guys would almost be together from the get-go. That wasn't the case with head coach Mike Keenan. It took him until Game 2 of the finals to play Lemieux and Gretzky on the same line. Was it a case of him protesting too much and keeping those two apart for so long, or part of a strategy to unleash them when it, quote-unquote, really mattered?
It depends on who you ask, and I'm going to say, just because Keenan did such a brilliant coaching job in that final series, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt on this one. And he maintains he always held that in reserve for when he really needed it, knowing it was there. And the way it played out, it was absolutely perfect, because when he put them together, there has never been a more dynamic partnership in the history of the game than Wayne Gretzky and Mario Lemieux during that last game and a half of the 87 Canada Cup series. So I'm going to give Mike the benefit of the doubt. And I know it was funny talking to all the players involved. You know, they were watching. They were, when's it going to happen? When's it going to happen? Because it was so obvious to them. What they had, and they could also see the chemistry that was developing both on and off the ice. between Mario and Wayne. And, you know, Mario has always said he learned so much. That was a real tipping point in his career, being exposed to those Oilers and understanding for the first time what it took to be a champion.
You know, as Jets fans and as in Winnipeg, we have to ask you about Dale Hawerchuk. We'd be remiss if we didn't. You know, he was sort of at first considered a bit of a long shot to make the team, even though he had come off a very successful year with the Jets. He did make the team. What role did he play for Team Canada in that tournament?
Well, it was anyone he was asked, which is so funny, and it was one of my favorite parts of the story because of my time in Winnipeg, and I developed a bit of a relationship with Dale, and I found him to be a thoughtful, really intelligent guy. I saw a lot of the big picture things in the game, and it was always good with the media. You're absolutely right. I know there's an anecdote early in the book where he's experiencing this self-doubt. He's not a Keenan type player. They had all kinds of skill at center. So, you know, the things he offered, you know, they had, but he just put his head down and found a way. And he contributed as a winger. He contributed as a checker, as a scorer. All the things, I mean, in Winnipeg, he was a little more one-dimensional. He was, you know, he was obviously the offensive guy. He put up tremendous numbers, but I don't think people saw the well-roundedness and the intelligence of the game. And he was such a smart hockey player. And I think that's what allowed him to fill all those roles. And, did this sort of widening the point of it. I think it's something, Doug Gilmore was at a different point in his career, but he went through the same thing. He would kind of establish himself as a go-to guy in St. Louis. But on that team, he had to look around the fringes. Where do I fit in? What can I best supply to this team? And he figured out a way, too. And they were both key figures in that Game 3.
Ed, we'll let you go on this final question. In the book, you call Game 2, which was the double overtime Team Canada victory, the greatest hockey game ever played. Was this three-game series the greatest series of hockey ever played?
I think taken in their totality, yeah. It doesn't have the drama. It doesn't have, all the peripheral stuff that went on in 72. I can't think of a Stanley Cup final that provided that. So I just think the quality of hockey, the quality of stars, the storylines that were going around, the drama with the Russian players, the drama with Eagleson, and then you've got this incredible three-set piece, each with its own storyline, building to the amazing climax with Gretzky setting up Lemieux for the goal. I just don't think it's ever been topped in the history of the game, and I'm hard-pressed to think of a circumstance where it will be topped, simply because, you know, the political, all those things, you know, the Russian-Canadian dynamic, that's long since dissolved. So for me, and I might not be the most objective source, for me it's the greatest series ever played.
The book is called Gretzky to Lemieux, the story of the 1987 Canada Cup. Ed Willis of the Vancouver Province, thanks very much for joining us this morning on the Illegal Curve
pleasure.
Hockey Show.
Yeah, my pleasure, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Take care, Ed. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot, Ed.
Thanks, Ed.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to Ed Willis of the Vancouver Province for having joined us earlier today. That interview will be available for download on iTunes. Search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Subscribe and get it sent to your iPod each and every week. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg, Dave Manouk, Michael Remus, and producer Tim. It's a full packed studio here this afternoon. This segment of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. For over 25 years, Rumors has been Winnipeg's home for the best in stand-up comedy. For a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Last night, tonight, Tom Arnold, concert series. You've seen him throughout the media in Winnipeg as he's been here. Terrific comedian. Sold out both shows last night. 7:45 show is already sold out of Rumors. A few tickets remain. And when I say a few, I mean very few tickets remain for the 10:30 show tonight to see Tom Arnold at Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. Give him a call, 488-4520, area code 204-488-4520. Or you can also buy tickets online at rumorscomedyclub.com. Gentlemen, yesterday was the one-year anniversary of the locomotive tragedy in the KHL. And I asked this question because there's, you know, now that we're getting closer and closer to an NHL lockout, more and more players may consider the KHL as the place for them that they would want to go play hockey until the NHL resumes. Would you, And I'm not going to ask this question as sort of a fringe NHLer that has decided to go play there. Guys like Mark Flood, who signed there earlier this year, Tim Stapleton, that sort of thing. As a professional, a clear-cut NHL professional, the Ovechkins, the Datsyuks, you know, the top-flight Russian talent in the league, knowing what we know of the KHL, would you go and play in the KHL?
Well, obviously, and this goes without saying, but what happened a year ago was the biggest tragedy to ever happen in hockey.
Absolutely.
It was something that was an international story, and it was extremely sad. Obviously, you know, affected people here with Brad McCrimmon. But, you know, as far as, you know, going ahead, you know, Russian players or North American players wanting to make the decision, I think it has to have had an impact. And, you know, when you think about, you know, the system here, the aviation system that we have here versus what they have in Russia, how can it not cross your mind when a tragedy like that happens? But, you know, I have to believe that, you know, this has in a way made, you know, flying in Russia better. I don't know, obviously, enough about it, but I can't, you know, see this not having an impact on the superstars like Alexander Ovechkin or Datsyuk, or, you know, guys that are, you know, at different stages of their career that want to go play there. It can't, but you have to think that this is, you know, raised awareness and made flying in Russia better, because, you know, nobody ever wants to see anything like this ever happen again.
Let me read this quote. It comes from Yan Denis. He was a goaltender. He played a number of years in the NHL. His name is familiar. They pay the players pretty good, but that's where most, if not all, of the money is spent. The rest of the setup, it's not even close to the AHL. He played 2010-2011 with a team in a smaller market in the KHL. St. Petersburg, Kazan, UFA, I'm sure it's better with the teams that have money. We had our own charter plane, but it was one of those models that crashed. Not the nicest plane. The hotels, they're two stars over here. The NHLers, if they choose to go to Russia in case of a lockout, it's going to be a huge difference for them.
Yeah, I just can't see the big... I mean, you're going to get the guys, the Russian guys, going over there. Because you know, they want to play for their local teams. They have a lot of... You know, there's already talk of a number of them, like Malkin and Gonchar, who have, you know, ties to the area, who want to go back and play together. But, you know, that has to be a factor. I mean, you have to be thinking, do you want to be taking substandard? And I unfortunately, I don't know that I would agree with what Ezra is saying, because I don't know that this would make much of a difference. I really don't. I don't know that the KHL has had, you know, some sort of impact on the Russian, you know, aviation industry as a result. So, you know, would I feel comfortable going over there knowing that, you know, you're going to be going within these substandard, potentially substandard? I mean, I don't know, you know, I don't have any authoritative knowledge saying that I know that. But I would think that it's probably hasn't changed significantly. And it definitely would be a factor of whether you go to the KHL. Obviously, the money's good. You see guys like Tim Stapleton who went to the KHL, you know, to Minsk, if you will. But, you know, I personally just can't see the value, depending on what you think of the lockout, right? If you think it's going to be a short-term lockout, is there value? Is there value in going over there and playing? Or are you better off staying here, training with guys, and just getting prepared? And, you know, especially if you make good money, you know, making a Crosby-type salary, do you really need to worry about making the money in the KHL temporarily just to kind of, and, you know, to maintain your game? You know your game's already a high level. So, right. I personally don't see the big North American NHLers going over if they expect the lockout to be short-term.
You know, back to, you know, player safety and, you know, flying in Russia. I mean, none of us know. I wish I knew more about, you know, the aviation system in Russia, because, you know, it is important.
It's not good.
It's not good, and we know that it's not good. We've heard from, you know, Dave King wrote a book, a former coach, wrote a book, I believe it was called King of Russia, about his time coaching in Russia, and we've heard from players and had players on talking about this. And you know, regardless of your knowledge, your in-depth knowledge of it, the reality is people just know, these guys know that going over there, it's a little bit shaky. And unfortunately, that you know, that doesn't come across your thought process in North America. I mean, you just don't think about that. These days, when you get on a plane, you're fairly confident that you're going to get to your destination safely. So, you know, Dave and I might disagree with that, and that's fine. And again, I don't know if anything's changed. It's scary to think that something like this hasn't changed anything. But the reality is that these guys do think about their own safety based on what has happened in the past.
Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Coming up next, Bill Lindsay, television analyst of the Florida Panthers.
Hey, yeah. What you gonna do? You wanna get down? Tell me. What you gonna do? Do you wanna get down?
1 hour down, 2 hours to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mindell. Joined in studio today by a potpourri of characters. Ezzie Ginsberg to my left, Dave Manouk on his left.
We don't have any potpourri in the studio, though.
We could use some potpourri in the studio, let me tell you.
Yeah, it's getting a little sweaty and hot in here.
Richard Pollock's away this week. He's in Chicago. Michael Remus is here. Producer Tim is here. We're trying to get a hold of Bill Lindsay, the Florida Panthers television analyst. We're going to bring him on the air in a matter of mere minutes. So in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com for all your latest in Winnipeg Jets news. You know, the Florida Panthers are sort of an interesting team. Whenever the season does get started, and there's no telling exactly when that's going to come to fruition. But, you know, the Panthers were the unexpected winners of the Southeast Division last year.
Absolutely.
And they're sort of returning their same team that they had last year, with the exception of really Jason Garrison, who went to Vancouver, and they brought in Philippe Kuba to replace him on the back end.
Yep.
I thought Vancouver paid a little too much for Garrison, and he had a career year last year. But if Kuba plus, you know, a little bit of the, you know, the younger guys on their defense could maybe recreate to some extent what Garrison brought to them, you know, the Panthers are not necessarily a team that's going to take a significant step back, especially if, you know, if they get that goaltending situation solidified a little more, either through Roberto Luongo or Jakob Markstrom, their big, talented goaltending prospect.
They've got lots of young talent. They're arguably, they're top three, top four in the league, arguably number one in the NHL right now, blessed with young talent. You know, Jonathan Huberdeau, who was picked number three overall 2011, the same year, the Mark Scheifele draft year. The Florida Panthers they overachieved big time last year, and it's going to be tough for them to repeat again this year. Carolina's gotten better. But, you know, they're very well coached, Drew, with Kevin Dineen there, and the Florida Panthers were a really hard team to play against, and they haven't been a hard team to play against. Remember, last year was the first year they made the playoffs in either 10 or 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they were the laughingstock of the NHL for a long time. And, you know, they had to turn it around. There was ownership issues, player personnel issues. So they really have turned around their season, and I think Dale Tallon deserves some credit for it, and I think Kevin Dineen deserves a lot of credit for it.
Exactly right. I think we got the thumbs up over there.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
And let's welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He's the Florida Panthers television analyst, Bill Lindsay. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me. How are you guys doing up there?
We're doing well. How are you doing down in sunny Florida?
Yeah, it's nice. It's hot. But other than that, everything's good.
Well, that's good to hear. Bill, we want to start with Roberto Luongo and the comments he made earlier this week. It was, almost a very awkward situation where you had Scott Clemenson and Jose Theodore working out, skating together, and then Roberto Luongo almost, you know, was on the ice at the same time as them. You know, do you think that in light of Luongo's comments this week that he wants to be traded back to the Florida Panthers, do you think that will increase the pressure on the Panthers front office to get a deal done?
I don't think so. They're going to do what's right for the franchise. I know Roberto and his wife, and being down here for a long time previously, factors into that decision. And I know Roberto would like to come back here. But I think the front office, I mean, these guys are everything's professional, and they want to make the right move for the hockey club. So if they feel it's best and feel that that's the right move, then I think they will make it. But I don't think those comments will add any extra pressure. I know Dale Tallon's very secure in what he does and what he believes in. So he would not pull the trigger unless he was 100% positive.
Bill, as you know, the Panthers have a lot invested in young goaltender Jakob Markstrom, and they obviously have high hopes for that young goaltender. Why would Dale Talon and the Florida Panthers want to trade for Luongo and his long-term contract, knowing that Jakob Markstrom is waiting there and they want him to be the number one goaltender one day?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. If you think Markstrom's going to be that guy, then I honestly don't think you make the move. I mean, if you're going to commit, obviously with Luongo's contract, it's got a no-trade clause. He's going to have to agree to be moved down here, but I think if they think Markstrom's going to be the guy here down the road, I'm not sure they would pull that trigger. So it's something that they would have to factor in. Maybe Markstrom moves in the deal. I don't know 100%. But I think if Markstrom, if you think he's the guy, then I don't think you make the move.
So the Panthers lost Jason Garrison in free agency, and they signed Philippe Kuba. Are they expecting Kuba to replace Garrison's production, or will it be more of a committee attempt to replace what you lose in Garrison?
I think Kuba, they're going to expect some things. You know, he's got that similar shot, that big shot from the blue line. I don't think it's quite on the level of Garrison's. I mean, that's one thing that you can't replace, that big slap shot, that booming slap shot on the power play. But there will be different places, different defensemen put in different places to see how it goes. But from an offensive standpoint, they would like to see Kuba, you know, produce a little bit. So it's something that they would like him to try and continue. Kuba's a little bit older. But losing Garrison is definitely something that is a factor that you don't have, you know, that big booming slap shot. So they're going to have to find some people to fill that hole.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, by Bill Lindsay, Florida Panthers television analyst. Bill, you look at the Panthers' back end there, and you got a couple guys who are, you know, 35-plus in Ed Jovanovski and Philippe Kuba. You got Brian Campbell, who's certainly been a seasoned veteran in the NHL. And then you have Eric Gudbrandsson, who was a first-round pick a number of years ago. The guy who's still unsigned that's really should play a big role on the Panthers' back end is Dmitry Kulikov. What's happening with those negotiations, and is there any sort of progress on that front ahead of the September 15th potential work stoppage?
It's something that, I mean, they continue to talk, and I know the Panthers would probably like to try and get that deal done, and Kulikov's in an interesting situation where he can become an unrestricted free agent pretty early. So, I mean, that factors into his decision. But I think it's something that they would like to get done. And obviously the money has to be right down here in Florida, something that they both agree on. But there's no question that they think Kulikov is a high-end defenseman, someone that can really produce and is really starting to come along. So that is a deal that they would like to get done. But they have to find somewhere in the middle where both parties are happy. But they would like to get that deal done, I'm sure.
Last season, you know, so July 1st, I guess that would be 2011, the Florida Panthers were the most active team in the free agency market simply because of need. They had very few guys signed. They had to get up to the salary cap floor. That resulted in them bringing in guys like Chris Versteeg and Scotty Upshaw and Thomas Fleischman. You know, this past year wasn't as active in terms of the free agency market, but one guy they did bring in up front was Peter Mueller, ex of the Phoenix Coyotes, ex of the Colorado Avalanche. A guy that if he ever stays healthy, it could turn out to be one of the better bargains in free agency. What are the Panthers hoping to get out of Peter Mueller this season?
Well, I think you just said it. Health. I think health is the big thing for Peter Mueller. If he can stay healthy and produce, he's still a young guy. And, you know, he's shown signs at a time that he can be a top six forward in the NHL. So if he can stay healthy and continue to produce at the level that he thinks that he can, then definitely it's going to be a bargain. Obviously, there's some risk with the head injuries that Mueller's had, but if he stays healthy and produces, then the Panthers got a great signing and a great hole to fill, and I think it's a chance at that price that's worth taking.
So one of the key players for the Panthers' success last season was Chris Versteeg, who signed a contract extension this offseason. Was this a case of the Panthers signing a guy at the peak of his success, or do you think this was just the tip of the iceberg for Versteeg? And more importantly, did he just like playing against the Jets, where he seemed to appear to score multiple goals every game?
Yeah, he had a great time against the Jets, for sure. He was able to score a lot of goals and produce a lot. So I think Versteeg's a guy that's shown a ton of upside, shown that he can be a 25-30 goal scorer in this league. So if he can continue to produce at that level, then I think Versteeg is someone right in the prime of his career. And if he can continue along that path, I mean, Chris Versteeg was dynamic at times. You know, against Winnipeg, you guys saw that. But he has the ability to be a game-breaker. So I think it's a good signing. He produced, and they just hope with the long-term deal that he'll continue at that pace.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. We're joined by Bill Lindsay. He's the Florida Panthers television analyst.
Bill, earlier this week we heard that some of the 19-year-old junior-age players who played some time in the NHL might get an exemption. There might be the chance that there's an exemption that a guy like Jonathan Huberdeau might be able to play in the AHL. Obviously, the AHL affiliate with the Florida Panthers, the San Antonio Rampage. When are the Florida Panthers going to make that decision to maybe let Jonathan Huberdeau go? And for that matter, some of the other guys that are kind of not necessarily guys that are going to make the team, when are they going to make that decision knowing that there's all this uncertainty with the CBA?
I think you wait till the last minute possible until you absolutely have to decide whether you want to make that move and put him down there. I mean, they want Huberdeau playing hockey. There's no question about that. They don't want him sitting around and doing nothing. So, but you're going to wait till the last second. He's someone that has to play. He's young. So wherever he fits in and wherever they have to make a decision to move forward, then I think they do that with Huberdeau. But I don't think you'll see that move made until they absolutely know or they have a good feeling what's going on with this CBA agreement. But Huberdeau's a guy that, right now it looks like to be penciled in on this team once the NHL gets moving.
Bill, we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you about Kevin Dineen. Obviously, last year he was at a very successful rookie season as a head coach. The Panthers exceeded all expectations with their Southeast Division championship. You know, what does Kevin Dineen have to do in his second year as a head coach to build on that success?
He's got a good rapport with the players. I think just keep doing what he's doing. He's been, he coached in Portland for 6 years in the minors. He's been around. He's played, well over 1,000 games. He was one of the top leaders when he was in the NHL with Philadelphia and Hartford and the teams that he played for. So he's got that credibility. But I think I think Kevin Dineen's going to be more confident than ever, after his rookie year, what he was able to do with his hockey team. So I think he believes 100% in what he can do as a coach. And I think he's just going to install the systems and help build this young hockey team. And one thing about Kevin, he's good with the young guys and he's a proven leader wherever he's been. So I don't think there's any problem. I think the only thing with Kevin Dineen, his confidence is just going to continue to grow as a coach.
You know, the Florida Panthers, we mentioned off air that, it's been this past season was their first real success in almost a decade. Now there seems to be a sort of a sense of stability around the team. Dale Talon's the general manager. You're in good hands there. Kevin Dineen is the head coach. Ownership seems to have stabilized. How important is that sort of continued stability to the Panthers continuing on an upward trend?
Yeah, I think it's really important. There was so much change here over the years when they missed the playoffs for 10 straight years, finally get in last year. So, I mean, there was so much turmoil. So that stability, I think, is something that is much needed down here in South Florida. Consistency, coach, GM that's in place, program that they want to build on, have one direction to go in. I mean, we were changing directions, every single season. New coach, new GM, new team, new philosophy. So I think they have trust in Dale, what he was able to do, and I think Dale has trust in himself. So I think stability is a huge, huge factor here in Florida.
Bill, we'll let you go on this last question. We mentioned last year the unexpected first-place finish. Southeast Division champions go 7 games in the first round against the New Jersey Devils, lose in overtime. What are the expectations for this Panthers team whenever the season does indeed get started?
Yeah, continue to grow, continue to get better. That's the thing. That's the thing. Once you have expectations now put upon you, there becomes a little bit more pressure. They show that they can succeed. So this team has to continue to develop. The young players that are coming along have to come into the system and they have to produce. But with the Panthers here moving forward, I think that's something that, it's like being a 30-goal scorer and getting that contract. Now you expect those type of things. There's a little bit more pressure, but this team was built last year, and they had a lot of success, and I don't see any reason why they can't continue to build on that.
Bill Lindsay, Florida Panthers television analyst on Fox Sports Florida, thanks very much for joining us this afternoon on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
You're great, guys. Appreciate it.
Take care, Bill.
Out there in Winnipeg, and hopefully we got hockey soon. We're looking forward to it.
Hopefully we'll see you sooner rather than later. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290 and the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Welcome back. back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to Bill Lindsay, Florida Panthers television analyst, for having just joined us. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available for download on iTunes. Search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, subscribe, and get it sent to your iPod each and every week. While you're at it, you can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website is www.illegalcurve.com. This segment of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show is brought to you by our good friends at Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza, home of Canada's only coal-fired pizza oven. Taste the difference at Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza, 1580 Taylor Avenue, pizza baked, well done. We were there last Monday.
For the football draft.
Football draft,
yeah.
We'll be there this Monday.
Yeah, the post-celebrations for the greatest championship team this summer.
That's right.
Which Drew and I were on.
The softball championship.
The House of A.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the Gold Eyes.
No, that'll be later on. That's it. They haven't won yet. Paul Edmonds is going to join us in a little bit, in about an hour or so, to talk about the Winnipeg Gold Eyes. But no, we're going to wrap. We're going to do our end of season wind up for our softball team at Carbone. Yeah.
I didn't get an invite.
You're not on the team.
I used to be
alumni.
I'm alumni.
I know. You're still not on the team.
Or invited.
Yeah, that goes without saying. Anyways, we thought we would spend the next couple segments, given that it's the anniversary of the 87 Canada Cup, and it's also around the same, it's very close to the anniversary, I guess this would be the 40th anniversary of the Summit Series.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We thought we would take the next couple segments and break down four of the most famous Team Canadas.
Right.
That being the 72 Summit Series, the 87 Canada Cup, the 02 Team Canada Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City, and the 2010 Vancouver team for the Vancouver Olympics. I know there are other Team Canada teams, but time restraints, and very much a case can be made for the 1976 team being better than the 1972 Summit Series team. But for the interests of time and for the interests of historic significance, I don't think you can make the argument that the 76 Summit Series team is more important than the 72 Summit Series team.
Probably not, but some people actually do think that team is better. And it's funny, talking about this off-air, about the 1972 Summit Series team, it was so historic for so many reasons. Obviously, there were four games in Canada and then four games over in what was then the USSR, Soviet Union. And there was actually a game here in Winnipeg, which was the only tie game of the series. And obviously, Canada fell behind in that series and ended up coming back and winning the final three games. But, there was so much going on there, politically, between the U.S. and the Soviet Union,
it was North America, and
North
the Soviet
America,
Union.
The Soviet Union.
This is only 3 years after. You got to keep the.
Absolutely.
This is 3 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Absolutely.
So the world is on the brink of a nuclear holocaust potentially.
Mm-hmm.
With the missiles being pointed at the U.S. from Cuba and everything else. So this is still the backdrop, is the communism, the big Russian machine, the fear, the red menace is still very much alive in 72. Less so in 87 as it began to sort of be chiseled away.
Yep.
But, in terms of the political significance, it was more significant in 72 than I think it was in 87. But you look at the roster, you look at Canada in 72. You got Phil Esposito, obviously Paul Henderson, Bobby Clark, Yvonne Cornwallier, Brad Park, Dennis Hull, J.P. Parise, Rod Gilbert, Jean Rattel, Gary Bergman, Ron Ellis, Gilbert Perreault, Bill Goldsworthy, Frank Mihaljevic, Pete Mihaljevic, Bill White, Wayne Cashman, Serge Savard, Stan Mikita, Red Berenson, Guy Lapointe, Mickey Redmond.
Who does TV now for the Red Wings.
Okay, there you go. Don Ari, Vic Hadfield, Rod Sailing, and Pat Stapleton. That's part of Team Canada's forwards for that final series against the USSR. Remember, this is a team now that's playing without Bobby Orr.
Right.
Gordie Howe was playing and not on that team either. He was, I believe, in the WHA at that time.
That would be right. Same with Bobby Hull.
Bobby Hull was
Bobby
not
Hull.
Allowed to play. And at the time,
right.
Everyone knows this. Was considered the greatest player, in the world.
That's
so
right.
There were guys on that team that weren't included, and there were guys on this team. We talked about the defense in 1987 with guys like Norman Rushfort and Craig Hartsburg, Doug Crossman. Their defense wasn't as stacked,
right?
Because you didn't have some of the star players. But the funny thing with that 1972 Canada Cup team, and there have been
Summit Series team.
Pardon me, Summit Series team. And there have been documentaries made about this. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I've watched every single game. You know, my dad talks about being at that game and stuff. It's one of the historic moments in Canadian sports. It really is.
Well, Drew, and weren't you at that game?
I wasn't actually at that game. And for the record, because I knew there was going to be an age joke that was coming, Dave Minuk is significantly older than I am.
Okay, boys. Well, you know, all jokes aside, the thing with that series is Canada at that time didn't know as much as they do about their competition. And at that time, and that's right. What's so
the Russians were a completely foreign entity to Team Canada. Even in 87, we weren't as familiar with the Russians, but we'd seen them a number of times over the years. In 72, it was the first time it was best on best.
Yep.
And, you know, so Canada went into that tournament not really knowing what Russia could do. And honestly, for the first, well, all the games that were played in Canada, it seemed the Canadians were almost a step behind because they couldn't get a handle. The Russians played a much different game than the Canadian teams did, and it took them a while to get up to speed with how the Russians were playing hockey. They had almost reinvented the game that Canada was used to.
Well, unlike what we're used to now, there's no instant knowledge about everything.
There's no scouting.
There's no nothing. Exactly. So you literally don't know anything about your opponents. So these guys are coming in, and the Russians are a formed group, as Drew said, and you know, really, you're sitting there going, you've never seen some of these moves. Some of these guys, things that these guys are doing, you're like, wow, what is that? You know what I mean? Especially because these guys are playing as a collective unit. But the interesting thing, really, and Drew hit on this earlier, was this idea of, like, nationalism within sports, right? And so, you know, on the heels of, you know, you got the Cold War ongoing, and you've got these national teams playing each other. And you listen to Esposito talk about it and all those guys, it was hate. They hated them. It wasn't that they just wanted to beat them. Like now, you know, guys don't hate each other. There's not that same, you know, dislike. You didn't hate them because of their, you know, you might dislike, you want to beat another country, but that's only because you want to beat the other country. They hated the Russians. The Russians, I don't know because you don't really hear it as much, but the Canadians hated them.
And it's funny, Dave, just sorry to cut you off there, but it's funny, you know, looking at, you know, we're going to compare 1972 the 1972 Summit Series team versus the 87 Canada Cup team, and you can't just look at the talent on the ice. Because if you look at the talent on the ice, it's not even close. You had Gretzky, Lemieux, Howardchuk, Messier. It's 87. Or I would make the argument that, you know, those are some of the greatest players of all time.
Mm-hmm.
But that 72 team, because of what was going on in the world, and because they had to go to Russia down three games, the way that team came together, and remember what happened with Allan Eagleson coming on the ice with all of the bad calls that they were getting from the Russian referees, and JP Parise swinging a stick at the ref, everything that was going on there, the fact that the team came together in Russia, and I mean, a lot of these guys, maybe all of these guys, I don't think had ever been to Russia before. That was like going to Mars. If you're like a guy on the prairies going to Russia, it's like this completely different culture.
A guy from Flin Flon, if you will.
You're going into, you know, enemy territory, and, you know, everything that was going on, the fact that these guys were able to, you know, rally the troops, so to speak, come back from three games behind. Everyone knows the iconic Paul Henderson goal. You could make a strong argument that that was the greatest hockey team of all time.
Couple things I should clarify. First of all, I said the Cuban Missile Crisis was in 69. I meant 63, 9 years before the Summit Series.
Well, it's okay. You were only 10 back in the 60s, so.
Thanks, Ezzy. I appreciate that. And the goaltenders, I should have to mention the goaltenders on the Team Canada. And Tony Esposito and Ken Dryden were the two goaltenders,
of course,
that played there. Obviously, two tremendous goaltenders. We know enough about both, and we don't need to rehash that.
Yep.
Let's look at the 87 team, because people are, and we want to hear from you. You know, what team was best? 72, 87, 2002, or 2010? Send us your comments on Twitter @IllegalCurve. A number of people have already done so. You know, the 87 team. You look at the forwards up front. Because the defense, as we talked about earlier in the show with Ed Willis of the Vancouver Province, the defense, aside from Bork and Coffey, was nothing to write home about. But you look at the forwards, and obviously, you know, it starts with Gretzky and it starts with Mario. So you got Gretzky and you got Mario Lemieux. You got Marc Messier, who was, you know, obviously probably at some of the peak of his powers at that point. Dale Hawerchuk of the Jets had played a significant role.
Yep.
Claude Lemieux, Dougie Gilmore, Brian Propp, Philadelphia Flyers. The Flyers were just hitting their peak in that 87. They were taking the Oilers to, they had those two great series in the Stanley Cup. Rick Tocchet, Brent Sutter, Michel Goulet, Kevin Dineen. We just talked about him in his role as head coach of the Florida Panthers. Glenn Anderson, key component on those Edmonton Oilers winning teams. Mike Gartner.
Oh, was Mike Gartner a great skater?
Fabulous skater.
Unbelievable.
Exactly. Just a, I mean, somebody. I'm reading the book, the Ed Willis book that we talked about earlier, and it, I think somebody describes Mike Gartner's skating as he was floating above the ice.
It was effortless. I mean, 87 to me is one of the most significant years because I was young enough to appreciate the hockey that was being played, and I followed it like religiously. And it was unbelievable how good. I mean, you have Lemieux, you have Gretzky, you have all these guys that are you're used to seeing compete against each other, and it's like an all-star team, and they're playing for their country. I love their jerseys, by the way. It's one of my favorite Canada jerseys of all time, without question. And again, like I said, I don't know what it is, but I just love the 87 Canada Cup.
And we talked about the context around the 1972 Summit Series. There was also context pretty significant as far as what was going on. Obviously, that was closer to what was happening in Russia, and you know, communism was ending and everything like that. But the problem is about what was going on then is that Russian players were still not coming over. So you still had these guys, like we were talking about off air, you had the KLM line, the Vladimir Krutov, Igor Larionov, Sergei Makarov, and that was, I believe, a year before Makarov came over and played with the Flames. I think that was 88, that year that he came over and played for the Flames. And then you had all of those other guys that were on the Russian team that we didn't know a lot about. So there was still, it was almost at that time, that was still obviously around two when the Russians, what was going on with the juniors, and the Russians were getting better at the junior level and starting to beat Canada on a regular basis, and there was fear that, you know, Canada was kind of losing its touch a little bit. And really, I mean, this was still a very important tournament. I mean, this was at a time when there wasn't NHL participation in Olympics. That didn't happen until 1998. So, I mean, this tournament was still very, very important to Canadian hockey fans and Hockey Canada. And as we saw in the best of three final, every game was 6-5. It was mm-hmm. close. The Russians played extremely well.
Well, I mean, you look at the three games. The first game, I mean, you know, second game was the double overtime game.
Right.
You know, the famous game where, I mean, I think Lemieux and Gretzky played the entire overtime practically, minute after minute. You know, the game three ended, you know, with that famous goal with 90 seconds to go or however length of time was. The first game, Team Canada was down 4-1 and came back to take the lead, then give up the lead, and then end up losing, I believe, in overtime, if I'm not mistaken, on that one. Let me go back here. It doesn't say exactly, but I'm pretty sure that one also was in overtime. So, you know, these games were just the most amazing games of all time. It was in overtime. And it's hard to believe that the 87 series, just with the talent that was on the ice on both sides, could ever be topped. And, you know, and I'm not going to ask you now. I'll save it. Let's go to break. We'll come back and we'll talk about the 02 and the 2010 teams. But it's going to be hard for the 87 team, I think, to not be the greatest Team Canada of all time. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290.